Good morning. Would you give us your statement briefly, please?
Yes. About 10, I cracked up big time, and I didn't know what was going on, and I went to the GP, and I couldn't cope, and I couldn't concentrate.
Start over again, please.
Sorry. Okay.
We can't hear you very well.
Okay. 10 years ago, is that okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
10 years ago, I cracked up big time. I went to my GP because I didn't know what was going on and I couldn't cope and I couldn't concentrate, and he kept saying, oh, well, you're tired, you're doing a lot, you know, go away. And this carried on for a while, and then eventually he said, would you go and see a psychiatrist? So I said yes, you know, because I was so desperate to sort out what was going on in my head. So I went to see the psychiatrist, who said I was depressed and would I go into hospital for a few weeks. I said yes, thinking, well, they'll be able to help me and sort me through this, because I didn't quite know what was going on. I went in initially for 3 weeks as a voluntary patient and discharged myself the next day because I couldn't cope being in hospital. I couldn't believe it. It was like one flew over the cuckoo's nest. You know, people would queue up for their medications, and I was standing there thinking, what is going on here? I shouldn't be here. You know, I'm not mad, although I probably was. and so I discharged myself. I overdosed, and this began a vicious cycle, really. I couldn't cope at home. I couldn't cope in hospital. And eventually I was going back and forth to the general hospital for the overdoses, and then they took me back to the psychiatric hospital, and then they sectioned me. And that was the start of an 8-month detention, really. I was sectioned for 8 months. Then I got out for 6 months, and then I was in for another 3 1/4 years. So altogether I was in for 4 years under section, and 14 months of which was in a secure unit. The absolute hell of it was the way they treated me. I used to, just because I was depressed, it didn't mean to say that I couldn't ask questions. And I used to question everything they did or said, and the staff didn't like that. And I think I was known as a troublemaker. They also didn't like me sort of suggesting that what they was doing wasn't quite right, because they were bullies with some of the other patients. And I was sort of almost outcast, I felt, by staff. One instant, I will give as an example, I had overdosed and came out of the general hospital and returned to the psychiatric unit, and the staff shut me in a room, and I was so distressed. I felt mentally and physically unwell because of what I'd taken, and they wouldn't talk to me. The consultant had told them not to talk to me. I wasn't allowed to talk to patients, to my friends, even though my friends tried to visit me. And I was incarcerated in that room for 2 days, and I ended up rocking myself for comfort because I was so distressed. They wouldn't give me any medication to help me calm down or sleep, and it was absolute hell. And that was just one incident. Another incident was I was shut in a padded cell. I kept absconding. I was known to be difficult in that I was running away all the time, and I used to be picked up in a police van and taken back, and I was carried by staff and injected in the buttocks, and that was just in the acute psychiatric wing. Eventually, my label changed, and I was then labelled as borderline personality disorder, I think because of the absconding and the overdosing. And even after that time, you know, I'd been in there so long, I would have thought that they'd known that hospitalisation wasn't working for me. But however, they thought they'd send me somewhere else. So they sent me to a secure hospital, which is a forensic one. I was under forensic psychiatrists there. I've never committed an offence. And I was in there. I had to share a ward. I say a ward. It sounds a bit nice, really, but a place with 35 other people, several who were murderers. A lot of the men had committed violent acts and sexual abuse and very nasty things. Most of the women were known as self-harmers, as I was, because of the overdosing, although I do consider that overdosing is different from self-harm, but again, that's an opinion. I don't know what else to say, really, except that it was absolute hell.
Could you... Could you clarify for us, by way of what else to say, which of these times you were there volitionally, that is, that you decided that you wanted to be hospitalized, And which of the times you were there?
The first day.
Pardon?
Only the first day.
First day?
Yes.
So when you talked about a 3-week period, the rest of that period was
well,
all...
I discharged myself the next day.
And didn't get out for...
I went home and overdosed. I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't cope at home. I couldn't cope in the hospital.
So after that one day, every time that you have described has been time that you spent involuntarily.
Yes.
Could you explain sectioning? Because not everybody understands that term. It's
sorry.
A British one.
Yeah, sectioning means that you're detained under the Mental Health Act, so it's an involuntary admission. It's not voluntary. I didn't choose to go. I was forced to stay there, just to make that clear.
Is one sectioned for a period of time?
It usually, I was on a section 3, which is for 6 months.
Wow.
So it was renewed every 6 months, and then after a few of those, it's renewed for a year on a yearly basis. In the secure hospital, I felt it was very unfair that I'd been sent there because I hadn't committed any offence and I couldn't really understand why I was. And then that's when I learnt out about personality disorders because I didn't even understand what that was.
Could you explain what the secure hospital means? Secure, yes, is that such a tricky term?
Sorry. It's a forensic hospital. I was in a medium secure hospital and the next stage up is high secure, like Rampton, Broadmoor, and those hospitals.
And in what way are they secure? Like how many locks?
It's like a prison. You're locked in. You can't get out. You're locked in.
Mm-hmm. You're locked in the other one too, aren't you?
No, because the doors would open. The doors weren't locked in the acute psychiatric hospital, but I was specialed, which means that you're on a one-to-one with a nurse all the time. So I couldn't leave because I had a nurse with me all the time.
Uh-huh. Who makes the decision concerning the section? You said that every 6 months you renewed it.
Yes.
Are you in front of a psychiatric committee, a legal committee?
Have a tribunal. with a psychiatrist, a lay person, and a legal person.
Uh-huh. Do you know these people? Have you met them or just that day?
You meet psychiatrists before you go in.
Mm-hmm. How about the legal person?
No.
How long did
this... Stranger, in other words.
Yes.
Aha, uh-huh. And they're supposed to defend your rights, and they don't even know you.
No, they're supposed to decide whether to renew your section.
Oh, I see. Not to defend your rights.
Did you have...
Lawyers are supposed to defend rights, I thought.
did you have somebody representing you in front of the tribunal?
My dad.
Your dad was representing you?
Well, my dad was with me. But I think he was in a dilemma because he didn't know, he felt that if I was let out, I would kill myself. And although he supported me that it was the wrong place to be, he didn't really know what to do, so he just was with me for comfort, really.
How long did the procedure take? How long were you in front of the tribunal?
About half an hour.
And what type of questions did they ask you?
What would I do if I was let out, and things like that. I wasn't very well for a long time, and I did say some very silly things. I wasn't very insightful.
Can you tell us what you said, if this is not too embarrassing?
No, it's not personal, but then maybe you'd say that I should have been there. that's the problem, because I do remember, I mean, I can see it now on hindsight, but at the time, I really did think that they knew what I was thinking, and that I had to die, and that they knew that, and they said, well, what will you do if we let you out? And I said, well, kill myself, because I thought they would understand that that's what I had to do, and of course they didn't, and I was quite upset that they didn't. I can laugh at it now, but...
Do you think if you were allowed out, you'd kill yourself at the time?
I would have done, yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, yes, I would have done.
Done it.
But
yeah.
Then it wasn't the right place for me to be. I don't think... A hospital was certainly not the right place. I was abused. I was held down many times. I was given a lot of medication to just... dope me up.
At the moment when you met the tribunal, were you straight and sober or had you been drugged?
I was probably on some form of medication.
Interesting way to face trial. And do you discern a difference between being in a crisis, a personal crisis, even an existential crisis, where you're not sure you want to live the life you see ahead of you, it being you assume to be so miserable.
No, it was always in a crisis. I was very depressed. That's the only time I wanted to kill myself.
That's what I was trying to explain. Yes. But do you see a difference between that kind of life crisis and being mentally diseased?
Can you define it?
Well, I'd try to. And one is to be in misery, and the other one is an imaginary illness, probably.
Well, how would you define mine, then?
Well, I've certainly been in your position of being miserable.
But it wasn't misery. I wouldn't say that how I felt was misery. It was beyond misery.
Okay, beyond misery.
Yes.
But
it was like in a black hole, and I couldn't get out.
Yeah.
But I still don't think that 4 years incarceration was the right way to deal with that.
And the assumption that you were sick, like had a disease they could cure with their methods, that seems to me not provable, but I certainly know about misery and beyond misery.
I don't want to interrupt this train of thought. If we could return to yesterday's practice of identifying who we are, recalling that our audience doesn't see us, that would be helpful. You've heard from Kate Millett and Alon Harel, in addition to the witness. Esther.
I'd like to also say that I had ECT. I had two lots of six treatments, well, I say treatment like that, of ECT. And I did give informed consent, but I'd also like to argue that I don't think anyone can give informed consent in such a distressed state. I would have done anything to have made myself feel better or feel different from how I was feeling. So I think it is arguable about informed consent in such positions. And also, I'd like to argue a point about diagnosis, because we all know that psychiatry has no scientific ways, no chemical ways to do blood tests or whatever to diagnose a psychiatric illness, what they call a psychiatric illness. And then I was labelled as borderline personality disorder. I have tried to debate this with the psychiatrist who gave me this label, and he won't discuss it with me, even though I don't fit the criteria. And he just said it's an arbitrary decision, which I don't think is fair at all. And I do think that is against my human right, that I can't even get rid of this label now. And I think that, you know, this should be discussed, the whole issue of diagnosing and how you can move on, because you can't with such a label.
Right.
And that's why I was sent to the secure unit.
Esther Herzog, did you have?
Yeah, I have two questions. I understand that your father supported you, and he was with you all along. So I was wondering if there was no, he didn't try to get you out, and he didn't try to get to the media to expose this, the whole thing, the whole story. And how did you, didn't you try, I mean, your family and your relatives, didn't they try to get you out or to do?
They did
to come
towards
out
the
with
end,
him?
But I think they truly believed that it would help me. Initially, they thought that I would be helped, and that they were told by the services. They were shown round this secure hospital, and they were shown all the therapies offered and everything, but all I saw was drama therapy. I was offered drama therapy and was told to play with a doll, and I thought, well, who should be in therapy here? You know, and then I sort of didn't go there, and that was written in my notes as sabotaging the therapy because I wouldn't go back. And there are lots of things like that. I have looked at my notes. I've looked at my notes, and there's a lot of misinterpretation of what I've said. Again, which I can't. I have responded to. I've written things in my notes, but nobody reads them. So
you got to read the notes written about you by the doctors?
Yes.
How'd you manage that?
I asked.
Oh,
we are allowed to read the notes. But it's up to the psychiatrist's discretion. But I was allowed, and I just found it very upsetting because the person they were writing about, I didn't consider was myself.
Mm-hmm. So at what point did your relatives do something about?
I was strangled. When I was in the secure hospital, I was strangled by another patient. And I think this actually shook me into a reality situation, and I thought, what am I doing here? Then I learned to play the game. I said what the psychiatrist wanted to hear, and eventually I got out, and I was taken off my section, and as soon as I was, I left. Mm-hmm. But my family did help me with that. So really, it saved my life.
Did you ever think at any time to have your relatives call an attorney?
I did see a solicitor quite often for the tribunals, but I think if a psychiatrist...
Was this person a solicitor you had hired?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And so actually in some of the tribunals you were in fact legally represented?
Yes, you were always legally represented.
Oh, but
by
I mean...
somebody that you could choose.
You can choose.
Yes, but if the psychiatrist has made a decision that you're not going to get off your section, you very rarely do. I don't know of anybody that has got off a section.
May I ask a bit about how the lawyers behaved? Did you feel that they aggressively pressed the case for your release?
No, I wouldn't say it was aggressive. I don't think there's a lot they can say, because you also have another report from another psychiatrist who comes in to give you an assessment. But I don't think that's impartial. I just feel that once you've got labels,
right. You've got an assessment that is already against your release, and you have a lawyer whose job it in theory is to press the alternative case for your release. Do you feel that the lawyer was doing the best that he or she could?
I think so, under the circumstances.
You just think it's hopeless?
Yes, I do. I think the whole thing is hopeless because it's all bureaucracy, it's all playing games. You know, you have a tribunal, you go in, you're represented by a lawyer, a solicitor. You're also given an assessment by another psychiatrist or clinical psychologist. Who's meant to be working for you, but when they've read your notes in the hospital, they're very biased, or I feel they're very biased.
What I was really doing was following that up. In my experience, occasionally, lawyers assigned in these cases take the same position as the clinicians,
yes.
That their first job is to decide whether you should get out, and if they decide that you shouldn't get out, then they simply walk through their role and don't...
Well, I think they do, because they have to, but they have to be seen to be doing, don't they? Because it's a legal right that you have a solicitor and you have another assessment.
If a criminal lawyer did that, he would lose his license instantly.
But they're not criminal lawyers, are they?
Yeah, but the results are even worse.
I just wanted to interject very quickly. I think it's good that you did not communicate the salutary effect of the strangling, because that could become a new therapy.
Dr. Leitman.
Well, I'm strangled by staff. He might never get out.
I'm still wondering about your kind of personal struggle. I mean, you came out after such a trauma and a awful experience. Didn't you take it as a personal struggle to bring it out, to fight for changes or anything?
I have been trying. I am taking legal action against the hospital for negligence. I am trying to bring awareness about diagnosis. I'm finding it very hard. It's taken me 5 years to get here, and I'm getting there. I'm not quite there, but I'm getting there.
You get the media on your side?
Yes.
Do they publish things?
I've had a few articles written about hospitalization.
Excuse me, Dr. Leifert.
Yeah. In your 4 years in the hospital, did any sympathetic person, a psychiatrist or anyone else, sit down with you and talk with you about your feelings and your life and why you were feeling suicidal?
No, they didn't have the time. There were a few nursing staff, especially night staff. I used to stay up quite a lot at night because it was the only time we had to talk to people, just to talk about normal things, whatever normal is, you know, about life outside, what's going on, just to have a conversation. So the night staff were quite good, really, and there were a few that were very kind to me. But it wasn't psychiatrists, unfortunately.
Hello, Harrell.
Yeah, I had a few questions. One is, you mentioned that you read the doctor's note and that you found them to be really alien to you. You didn't find them to reflect who you are. Could you tell us more about it? Could you tell us in what ways you think you were misinterpreted? Could you tell us whether there were factual lies or mistakes, or whether it's a matter of interpretation. Could you tell
us? No, I'll give you an example then. When about 4 months after I came out of hospital, I made an appointment to see the consultant that had labelled me as having a personality disorder, and I said I wanted to discuss the diagnosis with him so he was aware why I was going. I took somebody with me as an advocate, or just somebody else to listen, really. I took a tape recorder and I asked him if I could tape the consultation, because I usually get into a bit of a state and I just wanted to make sure that I heard what he was saying properly. And he became very defensive and he said, no, I couldn't. Then he wrote to my GP, and the letter he wrote, he said, Deborah demanded to tape the conversation, then he put in brackets, and she didn't even have a tape recorder. And just all these sort of insinuations, which was a lie. I did have a tape recorder, and I didn't demand, I did ask him. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just all these little words that they use, these power words, to make out that I'm the one causing trouble, really. I just think it's very unfair.
Is it fair to say that the misinterpretation was taking things that you ask and extenuating them or exaggerating them? In this case, it would be
the
difference between ask and demand, I guess.
A real tape recorder or none at all, that's factual.
I think a lot of psychiatric notes are fictional, because they tried to fit me into this diagnosis, and they actually got all my notes. I was in a different area in my 20s, and they got all my medical notes from there. I didn't see a psychiatrist then, so they were all medical notes. And I am a diabetic, so I was in a hospital quite a few times for hypos. And they've actually put them down as overdoses. So they're saying that I've been overdosing for years, which wasn't true.
Does your legal advisor, your solicitor, have a legal right to see the notes written on you by the psychiatrist?
Yes, but that has nothing to do with the case I'm doing now, because it's only to do with strangulation.
And your solicitor used exercises, right? Has the solicitor looked at the notes? Do you know?
I think so. I think they have got the notes.
Dr. Vatz.
Richard Vatz at Towson University in America. Have you ever read the article on being sane in insane places by D.L. Rosenhan?
Yes. I felt just like that.
Yes.
Although I don't think I was all the time well, but that is how I felt.
The interesting thing to me there is that that recounts situations in which well-intentioned staff misinterpret everything to be consistent with a theory that they've come into to effect. So that, I mean, you can have badly motivated psychiatrists, and you can have well-motivated psychiatrists, but the rhetoric becomes consistent with the pre-established labels that they've...
They pathologize every behavior, and that's what happened, I feel, in my case. You know, I used to run away a lot, but that was seen as abnormal. Well, actually, I consider that to be a very normal thing under those circumstances.
One of the interesting parallels between that study and your testimony is that Dr. Rosenhan's students, who were pretending to be patients, were taking extensive notes, rather like your tape recorder.
And
I could just see it going down in your notes as note-taking behavior.
This is Ron Leifer here. May I say that I think you understand psychiatry much better than they understood you.
I certainly do now.
Kate Millett.
I didn't get that.
Well, I was wondering when the psychiatrist had your assessment.
Esther Herzog. Thank
you. Your assessment. Could you tell us about the conversation that you were having with him?
I've had several assessments. I can give you an early example of an assessment I had when I first went into the forensic hospital. that a psychiatrist came from Cambridge, and I really felt that he'd be on my side, and how silly I was, but I really saw, and I told him everything, and I was honest, and again, I just feel that he misinterpreted everything I said into making it into a disease of a personality disorder. So, I just couldn't win. Whatever I did, I couldn't win. And it just took being strangled to start playing the game. And it is a game, and it's wrong, in my opinion.
Kate Millett, could I... previously, I asked you questions to try to outline the difference between distress and disease, which they confuse, it seems. But your present solicitor, is this solicitor helping you to sue the hospital?
Yes.
And so he stands to gain as well?
Yes.
He does it for part of whatever you win.
Yes.
So are you happy with this solicitor? He's probably a little more diligent than the other one.
Well, I am actually, in that he knows nothing about mental health.
The other one thought he
and
did.
And he seems on the ball with the law. So, yes, I am happy with him. And yes, I feel I need to do it out of principle, because I might not win. But that doesn't matter. I need to do it out of principle, because they were wrong. They were wrong in what happened to me and everybody else. A lot of the people I was in with 5 years ago are still there.
No,
and they haven't moved on. And I think that is just fundamentally wrong.
I want to take this occasion to remind the audience that questions from the audience are perfectly appropriate at this stage as well. Only one request. Please raise your hand to be recognized so we can keep it orderly, and please go to one of the microphones so that you can be interpreted.
Joseph Perlstein, dissident from Israel. I have two rhetorical questions about the gray zone of the sufferer life. First of all, why in the atmosphere now, when you are or sane or mad, why isn't any social organ, social factor like the church, to put some goodwill upon these people, and let us, that at least the church, in acting in the name of the religion of God, to take some responsibility of these people for good when their families are so perplexed. Yes, so these people will have some place to run and to get some warm attendance. Second, about the law. I know the law about to treat the mentally ill people in Israel. It's a Nuremberger law, a law against men as being men, as being human beings. And the matter is, why does a law about treating people like us, when a solicitor is acting not as a psychiatrist wish, but as the law is ordering him, why is a law taken? And we are not taking part by appearing in the parliament. Nobody is recognized as people with wisdom that should be counseled before such laws are taken. And why are laws against suffering people always contain paragraphs like binding, like arresting, and like attending to them as criminals, as something who are only to harm? Why isn't anybody to understand that we are suffering people, and even when we are somehow behave not as required, maybe we are under such a stress that if this stress is removed, we will be seen as very sympathetic souls also. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ed, I've been asked by the jury to restate the second point. I believe it to be that the gentleman thinks it unfortunate that the community of victims of psychiatric abuse are not consulted more regularly by the legislature when laws are made on this subject. There was a Tom.
I would like to answer that question, because it's a very obvious one. The legislature does consult with the experts, but the experts are not the patients, but the doctors. This is part of looking at it medically. After all, when experts make laws about which pharmaceuticals to permit to be sold for pneumonia or gout or something, they don't ask patients with gout, they ask patients who are experts on doctors who are experts on gout. So this is part of the fact that this kind of torture that was so eloquently described is called medicine. It's not medicine. And Mr. Perlstein also raised the point that I thought I would make a small comment about, of why don't the organized churches help such persons in distress? Again, the answer is that the major recognized churches, the Christian churches, the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, the Jewish organizations, at least in America, are the most enthusiastic advocates and defenders of psychiatric brutality. And I think this is virtually never mentioned. Obviously, this is not an elegant thing to say, but this is an extremely important aspect of this thing. And I mentioned this in my initial statement, that you have the media, the medical profession, and the churches, all of these major churches, against the patient, invariably, consistently, always.
Can I reiterate that with you? Because I did actually ask for a vicar to come and visit me in hospital, and he wouldn't come. And, you know, I really felt I needed to talk to somebody outside, and he wouldn't come.
Well, I can only repeat Dr. Leifer's statement that your understanding of psychiatry far surpasses...
In the UK, we do actually have a national service framework now that is saying, it's a legal document saying that they have to consult user views, user and carer views now. A lot of lip service is being paid to that, but I don't think in reality it's happening yet, although the user movement is becoming a lot stronger in the UK now.
Sometimes that's called the consumer movement.
What's a movement? The use movement?
The consumer movement.
Oh, consumer.
A consumer is someone who chooses between buying a Chevrolet and a Ford.
Exactly.
Involuntary psychiatry is like having a whole automobile shoved down your throat, along with the gas, which is the drug. Do you hope to expunge your record, which will be like part of your life, probably? You'll be involved with employment and so on and so forth.
I would love to be given all my psychiatric notes and burn them, but they won't let me.
Is there any possibility of your erasing this record of your...
No.
First of all, there's a legal record of your commitment, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And secondly, there's medical records which call you crazy. I at least have them. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of hard to get at, let alone wipe out. Mm-hmm. Although there are ways in which you, if you really work at it, and you can get a complicit doctor, I've called with it, perhaps some help from a solicitor, then it might be possible to erase that. I understand it is in the United States if you're extremely canny. I haven't achieved it yet.
No.
But is that possible in Britain?
No. I have tried to do everything I can to get rid of, to argue the point, the diagnosis, everything. I've tried everything, and I can't.
Permanent stigma.
The only thing I hope to be able to do is perhaps if I do look at my notes again, and perhaps I shouldn't be saying this in public, is if they leave me alone, which sometimes they do because I've got volumes, and sometimes they just go away and I run away with them and burn them myself, and then I can just say, well, I'm mad.
Oh, you're not permitted to have copies, only to read them under supervision.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So it would be hard for your attorney to read them.
And he has had copies of them, though.
Sorry, have
all copies. Good.
A question, I believe, from the audience.
Sorry.
Deborah, I have short questions. Did you get, in case of the volume of psychiatric medicaments, neurolepticus, heavy depressions after? And another thing is, how are you organized in England or Cambridge in self-help groups, or we call it in some regions of Germany, experts and their own things. There's a book also of a self-help center and another idea. What we see more and more that empowerment in groups or empowerment of people who were in psychiatry, we are on the way to find out that sometimes or very often more effective way to get forward. You can never get back to the time before you were in a hospital, but it's burning in holes in the brain and in the soul. That's unforgettable, but just my question, are you good organized in self-help organizations or whatever?
I can answer your second part. I didn't catch your first part, but your second part, yes, we do have some very good user, survivor, consumer, whatever term you want to use, groups available, and they're very good, and I do sit on quite a lot of committees. There's now a research and development one set up because the main hospital in Cambridge is now becoming a mental health and community care NHS trust. So they're reorganising the mental health side of things. So I'm on a couple of those committees because, of course, they have to have a user view, and they've got me and somebody else. I don't know how much they'll take notice of me, but I'm going to be there to try and represent other users as well. So things are changing. I didn't catch your first part, though. I'm sorry.
It was just the question, the consequence of psychopharmaca or so-called modern atypical neurolepticas. Did it you bring in a deep depression after having to take under pressure these medicaments to get out of the psychiatric hospital?
Sorry,
for example, I don't.
He's asking about the effects of the medication that was forced on you.
Oh yes. Oh, sorry. I was put on chlorpromazine at one time. Chlorpromazine. I wasn't told about the effects it would have if you go in the sun, and so I've now got problems with my skin because I reacted very badly and got an allergy all over. I'm quite sensitive to medications, so. Yes, I did react badly to many of them, and I was on a lot. I was on haloperidol, chlorpromazine, you name it, I've been on it.
Yes, please.
Kate Millett.
No, Kate, just a moment, please.
Paulo Coelho, I want to go back to the strangling attempt. Do you think that the decision, the ultimate decision of releasing you, it was taken by your father or by the psychiatrist?
I think it was a combination of me playing the game and saying what I needed to say to get out and convince them that I was okay to be let out. My father pushing for me to come out as well. I think it was a combination of factors. And also because they realised that they were doing nothing to help me, and it was a waste of time me being there.
Too.
As well, it cost them nearly £250,000 to lock me up for all that time. I wish they'd sent me to a health farm. I could have been massaged, pampered, and had a good time. It would be much more beneficial than where I was put.
You'd still be paying salaries anyway.
Kate, did you?
May I ask? Did you feel that hospitalization was not only perhaps a depressing experience, but did the effects of having been hospitalized and stigmatized, did you feel that that brought on depression at all afterwards or in the course of things?
No, I don't, but I find it very distressing to think about it. It's something I will never forget or get away from. It will always be there, and especially the effects of being strangled will be there with me for the rest of my life. However, the only good thing is the people I met in the hospitals. You know, I did make some friends and met a lot of good, interesting people. So that was the only good thing.
We're being pressed, as always, by the clock. Thank you very much for your wonderful, candid testimony.
You're welcome.
I'm going to call another person now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.